Welcome to Lawmen, the podcast about local legends and obscure curiosities from days of yore. I'm Alistair Beckett-King.
And I'm Alistair's landlord and master, James Shakeshaft. Here's a cautionary tale about being annoying. This comes from a book called Oxfordshire Stories of the Supernatural.
That is quality front cover.
It is a generic front cover, unfortunately. It's a picture, it's sort of a blurred picture of a ghostly skeletal monk pointing at a book with a map that says Oxfordshire. And I thought, oh, that's quite cool and a neat book. And then I got one in the same range, Derbyshire Stories of the Supernatural.
They just changed the name on the map then, did they?
Changed the name on the map, yeah. And on the cover of the book.
Yep.
But this one's by Betty Puttick. Good name.
It's a Puttick, you know it's going to be good.
Betty Puttick. And this is a story entitled Never Say Bah. This happened in Oxfordshire as the skeletal monk.
Yeah. You're pointing at the
right
point at the book.
Yeah, and it was a guy called William Eden. His nickname was Noble. Noble Eden. He came to a sad end on his way home from Tame Market in 1828. And all because of his unfortunate sense of humour. Interest peaked?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, good. So what it was, Eden was a market gardener. And one day when he was, you know, doing his gardening in his garden, he saw two local wrong'uns, Sewell and Tyler, and they were stealing a sheep from one of his neighbours.
So I'm laughing at it as I'm visualising two men carrying a sheep.
Making off with a sheep, maybe putting it in a jacket. Yeah. It's, yeah, a lot of fun. But the penalty for sheep stealing was transportation or death at this time. So, Ed, when the police came round...
That would be transportation to Australia.
Yes, I guess, yeah.
Not just a lift.
Yeah, just you'd got to live on a train. So, Eden kept quiet when the police came round because, you know, he knew these people, they're local, they're my wrong'uns, but he doesn't want to kill them. But he was a bit of a japester. And so whenever he saw these guys knocking around the place, he would bar like a sheep, sort of to
That's
say...
That's what that implies.
Yeah, I've seen you, lads. He was amused by their, like, red faces and angry reactions, foolishly amused by it, because they very quickly realised that their liberty was reliant on his silence. And if you're the sort of person that's going to risk death or transportation to nick a sheep, you're not going to be above killing someone to shut them up, are you?
Probably not.
And he did it for a bit. And then he was about to return from Tame Market on this fateful night. And he seemed to have some sort of premonition. He told the friend he was travelling with that he feared something bad was going to happen to him. And his friend said, and this is noted here, his companion offered to continue all the way home, but Eden laughed it off and sent him on his way. However, Eden's premonition came true. Sewell and Tyler were lying in wait for him, and as he reached Anxie Bushes, he was set upon and murdered. Now, one of my favourite opening words for a paragraph in these sort of stories, meanwhile... Mrs. Eden was at home in the kitchen, and she saw a frightening vision. She looked up and saw her husband walking towards her, and behind him, unbeknownst to him, was Tyler with a heavy stone hammer about to bring it down on her husband's head. And then he did bring it down on the husband's head. And she screamed, obviously, she ran out screaming, "My husband's been murdered, my husband's been murdered." There was a search and they found the body of Noble. And as it says in this reporting of the story, it was too late. He'd been savagely bludgeoned to death.
Sorry, I shouldn't.
Well,
it's not appropriate.
I think it's an inappropriate sentence. She was convinced it was Tyler because she'd seen him in the vision. But unfortunately, a vision was not considered to be evidence in 1828. So the verdict at the inquest was murder by person or persons unknown. Now, she was not going to let it rest there, the widow. In those days, it was believed that the body of the victim of a murder would bleed when touched by the murderer as a sort of sign that this was, you know, the murderer. So she challenged Tyler to come and touch her husband's corpse. He didn't.
What could be more suspicious than refusing to touch someone's corpse?
I don't know. Like a man who barred at you all the time, his mad wife. And then, sometime afterwards, his son, their son, Eden's son, was driving home, and two men waylaid him in the dark and threatened to, you know, the same thing that had happened to his father. He didn't see their faces, and he managed to beat them off. Not my words, the words of Betty Puttick. And he escaped, but he was convinced by their voices that these attackers were Saul and Tyler. And then, before too long, Saul was imprisoned, and in prison, he sang like a canary. He hinted that Tyler was implicated in this murder, and Tyler was subsequently arrested but discharged because there was a lack of evidence.
Mm.
And Tyler's reaction to this was he adorned his hat and coat with coloured ribbons and danced around outside the houses of people that had given evidence against him.
If you testify against the boss, you're going to regret it. What's he going to do? He's going to dance around inside your house with a series of ribbons adorning his clothing, and it's going to be very mocking. So you are not going to enjoy that.
So yeah, so it seems they got away. But then Sewell was captured again, stealing chickens this time. And this time he really realised, look, I've got more evidence against Tyler. It was Tyler that, because this time he was going to get transported for 14 years. He just went all in. He said, I've got evidence against Tyler. I witnessed him killing him. This is me quoting Sewell. I witnessed Tyler kill him with a stone hammer. And this time they were both charged, found guilty, and sentenced to death.
So Sewell, he turned state's evidence.
But then he got
sentenced. But then they still sentenced him to death.
Yeah, on the 8th of March, 1830, a crowd of 5,000 people gathered outside Aylesbury Prison to see them hanged.
Mm.
Tyler swore that he was innocent right up till his death. But the he was basically hanged on the basis of a madman's mad widow's vision and a partner who wanted to get out of getting sent to Australia for 14 years.
I mean, so he wanted to get out of being sent to Australia, and in the end he was killed.
He was killed.
Which is a narrow escape, if ever there was one.
Yeah. And the ghost of Noble Eden, if you encounter it at the crossroads on the Tame to Aylesbury Road, this is a sign of good luck.
Does he bar at you?
I don't think he bars from beyond the grave, no. But I've always noticed...
He's out there behind still.
I have noticed when you see a bunch of sheep in a field and they do bar, there is always one that sounds like a bloke doing an impression of a sheep. There's like, meh, and then one just goes, bar. I just imagine that's a bloke in it, gone deep cover.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the... that's the story of Noble Eden. I think Noble must be an ironic nickname in the.
It's a fairly ignoble end.
Yes. Scores for Never Say Bar.
I can't believe that Never Say Bar is what the locals call this story.
It's not a James Bond film.
That's it. James Bond never does say bar at any point.
That's true.
In any of the films. So it could be a name of any one of them.
Mm.
All right. So what categories have you got?
Okay. Supernatural.
Supernatural. You've got a ghost.
Yeah.
Admittedly, he's just tagged on at the end.
Sort of tacked on at the end, yeah.
Sort of brackets, and also he's a ghost. And he's a good luck ghost as well.
Yeah, he's a nice ghost.
And we have a vision.
Yep.
Which is certainly outside of the realms of science.
Yes.
And we have corpses bleeding when you poke them.
The idea of it, but the idea of it doesn't actually happen. Yeah.
Anything else you want to pitch for being supernatural?
There's the Eden's premonition that something might happen that he very quickly brushes off.
He had a premonition and then she had a vision.
And then he becomes a ghost.
I'm looking at the book that is lying open here, and I can see something you said that I didn't realise was a direct quote was, a vision was not considered to be evidence.
Yes.
So I think it's a three. I think it's a three.
Yeah.
But and I think you should be glad of that, frankly.
Yeah, no, this is more of a true crime.
It's more of
hard-boiled.
More gritty.
There's a little bit of spice about it, but yeah, three's fair enough. Naming.
I think the names are quite good. Well, first of all, the name of the story is brilliant, Never Say Bar.
By Betty Puttick. So as told by Betty Puttick.
As told, yes.
William Noble Eden.
He's not particularly noble.
No, it's...
Maybe he had no ball.
someone stole it, and he would not dob him in, though. Which
because
he, that's my maybe why he's noble, because he doesn't grasp.
Well, I don't think that's particularly noble. The noble thing to do would be to bring people to justice. We've got Tyler and Eden and Sewitt was the other guy?
Sewell. Sewell and Tyler.
How is Sewell spelled?
Sewell. S-E-W-E-L-L.
Oh, right, yeah.
As in Brian.
Imagine if he spoke like Brian Sewell for the whole story.
Well, that would be how the kid recognised him in the dark as a threat.
I think we should stop saying things about us doing the murder and the sheep theft. It wasn't us.
We will treat you as we had treat your father.
Both of them sounded like Brian Sewell.
Yeah. Tyler. Nice rural name. Tyler.
Tyler as well.
Yeah, with an O-R at the end.
Anxie Bushes.
Anxie Bushes. Yeah. Tame is a place name I always find amusing.
Mm. That's right. It's spelt Thame, right?
It's spelt Thame, but it's...
I think these are all good names. I think it's a four.
Yes.
I think it's a good, strong four.
Solid four. If we'd known Mrs. Eden's first name, that might have been a little bit
more spice. If her name was called something like Hackety, then I would have given that five.
This category is Quest for Justice / Corpse Poking.
I like it because, as you said, it's a noirish thriller, and it sort of follows the killing style. There's been a murder, and we just unravel it over a series of ludicrous episodes. And eventually, she does get her man.
Yeah, a man who claims he was completely innocent is hanged to death.
Yes, so a happy ending for all concerned.
Yes.
Well, I didn't know about the corpse poking thing. That people believe that touching a corpse would cause it to bleed.
If you're the murderer.
They also used to believe that the eyes contained an image of the last person, the last thing you saw when you died.
Oh,
and
really?
So they spent ages photographing dead people's eyes, hoping that an image of the murderer would be, a bit later than this, in the 19th century, hoping that an image of the murderer would be in the eye. Mm. But it turned out not.
Or it was a cameraman who did the loading.
I can't believe I did all these murders.
Yeah, well, it looks like it was me.
So the corpse poking is cool, and her quest for justice is... And so she's fairly tenacious.
It's also the actions of a madwoman.
It is also the actions of a madwoman, but I think that's what makes her a gripping protagonist. I think it's five.
Although, on the other hand, it is the sad story of a mad lady hounding a person to his death. We've only got Eden's word that there even was a sheep rustling in the first place. It may be that these are just two innocent guys. He just started baring at them. Like a weirdo, and then was killed for being annoying. Someone else might have killed him because he was a madcap fool. And then this Mrs. Eden gets it in her head that it was Tyler what done it.
I don't think so. And here's, I'm about to lay my evidence on the table in front of you.
Mm.
That evidence is some ribbons.
As long as your evidence wasn't a vision.
No.
Because
it's the solid gold evidence that the dancing in ribbons is as good as a confession. That is incontrovertible cast iron evidence.
So wait a minute, because he's happy that he didn't get...
What? It's the taunting. The taunting makes me convinced that he definitely did it. I'm like the people commenting on that Amanda Knox documentary on Netflix. I don't care. I'm convinced. He did it.
But maybe he was going to go dance with ribbons anyway, and it just happened to be by there.
It's 5 out of 5. I don't know why you're trying to talk me out of it.
I don't know why.
I'm convinced he was guilty.
Okay. I don't know why I sighed there. I'm getting points. I'm getting 5 out of 5. I'll take those 5 out of 5s. And the final category, Heckler Put Down.
Explain the category title to me.
Well, because it's described in the story, and again, we've only got the word of Eden that this barring is a joke.
Well, because
it's not a very good joke.
You and I know that if in comedy gigs, if someone say if you say where you're from and someone says Wales, some wag at the back of the room will make a sheep noise.
Yes,
and no one ever laughs.
No,
and that joke happens consistently whenever anyone mentions Wales, for instance.
Yes,
which must be very annoying for the Welsh.
Yes,
so it is as heckles go, it's a rubbish heckle. Anybody who does it deserves to be violently bludgeoned.
Whenever it says in this version of the story, whenever he encountered them, he would bar like a sheep. It was a small town. They were moving in the same circles. He would just be barring. I mean, Eden sounds like a bit of a...
Probably one of those guys who, after the gig, come up to you and shake your hand as if they thought they were helping.
I was helping in your sheep rustling. And it just got too much, yeah.
As bad jokes go, every comedian has died on stage.
Mm.
Not that many people have been actually murdered because of their joke.
No.
So the consequences were very serious for Noble.
So wait a minute, in this... No, but he's not the comedian, he's the heckler.
Yeah, he's the heckler now.
In this metaphor.
Yeah, I've mixed my analogies, I apologise.
So let's just get this metaphor straight. Tyler or Sewell are the comedians.
Yes.
Doing their hilarious sheep rustling routine.
Yes.
Noble Eden wants to be part of the fun, so bars
at
them whenever he sees them. They need to nip that heckle in the bud because it's ruining their act, sheep stealing. They kill him with a hammer.
They slam him with a hammer.
Yeah, or in comedy terms, a pre-prepared insult.
Yes.
Perhaps.
And then, as often happens in these situations, his wife chips in.
Yeah.
And they pull
out... tries to get you to touch him.
It just like happens in normal gigs. And so they, like most of us doing that situation, fall back on the ribbon dancing material.
Yeah.
You've made a strong case. I think it's a 4.
Red like a 5.
In this story, we meet the greatest writer in Wessex.
So, I have a story for you here. Well, not exactly a story. I have a local legend.
Yes.
In the form of a woman.
Right.
The author of many books. And her name, I have one of her books. I say books. You can see from the thickness of it. It's, I would say it's 4 millimetres thick. It's in the pamphlet area.
Yeah, that's... Wait a minute. If a booklet is a little book, what's a pamph with bigger? Is it held together with staples?
We have got staples.
That's a pamphlet.
That's a pamphlet, really. Yes.
That's one up from a pamphlet.
It may be a booklet.
Mm.
Yeah, it's like a little baby book. And her name is Patricia M. Wilnecker. Mm. When I read the name, I said to Rachel, my girlfriend, I said, Will Necker, I hardly know her. She wasn't familiar with that format of joke. It's a standard joke.
Yeah, that's a classic, yeah.
So I will refer to her as Patricia and Will Necker, I hardly know her. Throughout the rest of it. The reason I think she's a legend is, the book that I picked up is called Freshly Unearthed, Ghostly Tales of Wessex. From the font, it's not clear whether Freshly Unearthed is a series of books, and this is one of them, or whether that's just the full title. So, in Ghostly Tales of Wessex, Patricia M. Wilnecker has gone round... Did you say...
I say would that I could for this one.
There are other variations. She's gone round interviewing the elderly people of Poole, where she lives.
In Dorset.
In Dorset.
I would have bloody loved the place.
Shall we do that again?
No. So that's the similar to the Wilnecker paradox.
It's another classic
paradox.
This
the Wilnecker.
Wilnecker paradox, possible title for this episode. I don't. Yours is less applicable because it's someone's got to mention Dorset for it to work.
Not even that's. It's even worse than that. They have to mention somewhere that you know is in the Dorset. County of Dorset. I would. I bloody love the place.
Should I just set you up properly and we'll do it properly?
I'm keeping all this in.
So she's interviewed lots of people in the town of Poole.
In Dorset?
Yes, it is in Dorset. Sorry, did I do it wrong? I don't know what am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to say...
That's the thing. It's one of them jokes where both people are telling the jokes.
Right, sorry.
Sort of like a knock-knock.
I didn't realise there was pressure on me to do it.
Oh, my mate was telling me he's got like a kid, a son, who is just getting into jokes and knock-knock jokes. And for some reason, so the kid's grandparents, somehow they don't understand knock-knock jokes. Or they never want to be told them because he'll go up and go knock-knock and they'll go, yeah, I'm opening the door. Hello? And they go, no, who's there? So they go, oh, right, okay. So he goes, knock, knock. They go, who's there? And he says, you know, doctor. And they go, no one's ill, it's okay. Like, and they're not playing hard to get. Like, it's like they genuinely don't know how a knock, knock joke should work, be done.
That's extraordinary incompetence.
Or cruel on this kid. But they're right, you should nip it in the bud, because he's about to get to the point where he thinks he can make up his own jokes as two comedians.
Open mic children. Awful.
No, the in Dorset, of course I would have bloody loved the place. That's the thing. It's a call and response where both people have to sort of know the joke, so it is literally pointless in doing it. So someone mentions a town in the county of Dorset, and the listener says... as a question, endorse it.
And the other person, i.e. me, that
pretends
the first...
to mishear that as a request to endorse the place, and they say,
I bloody love the place.
Yes.
Well, I just said it then, so you could just edit that back onto.
It was a bit quiet, and to be honest, I don't want to give you notes, but you didn't sound like you meant it.
No, I've not been to Dorset, so I don't have any strong opinions one way or the other. On the other hand, I'll tell you who does, and that's Patricia M. Wilnecker. What I like about her is her prose is surprisingly engaging. She's written several books. Most of them are about either the school that she went to as a girl or her dog, Bounty, her Jack Russell. To the extent that both the school she went to and her dog, Bounty, the Jack Russell, are both mentioned on the back cover of the book, even though it's about neither of them.
There's a lovely picture of her.
There's a lovely picture of, which is a picture of her and Bounty, where Bounty is centre frame and she's veering, she's actually being cut by the edge of the frame. That's how important Bounty is, that she's not even in it.
And there is a picture of a building in the background.
Which, couldn't that be Parkstone Grammar School in Poole, Dorset?
It must be.
Her bibliography include a history of Upper Parkstone, the school, Upper Parkstone in the Second World War, more recollections of Upper Parkstone, that's the third instalment, Bounty, the Tale of a Dog, and if you Google her, that's the main one that comes up, Bounty, the Tale of a Dog, but she followed it up with Wessex Walkies for You and Your Dog, and more Wessex Walkies for You and Your Dog. And she's written a bit of historical fiction and non-fiction about things that have happened in Poole. But what I like about her is she is a master or mistress of irrelevant details. And I think this is demonstrated even in the title of the stories. These are the ones that are selected on the back as examples of the stories in the book.
All right.
The Man on the Bicycle. The Ghost That Scared the Plumber. The Gypsy's Phantom Devil Horse, which has a nice rhythm to it.
Oh, now that's got spice.
And The Old Dorset School. Oh, I wonder which school. In Dorset. It
she
is.
Definitely would.
My favourite one by far, and it's the last story in the book, The Strange Spoon.
Oh, no.
Which is just about a spoon. While she was writing the ghost story, she found a spoon in the last place you would think to find a spoon, her coffee jar.
What?
Where she definitely didn't keep a spoon.
So she found a spoon.
She claims to have been visited by a spoon. I was about to make a cup of coffee, and there it was inside the jar. I've closed the book, as if to say, case closed. And it is still there to this day, as far as I know.
Wow.
In the same coffee jar. Her writing is actually quite engaging. I like her irrelevant details, and I also like her use of capital letters. This is written in 1995. She's really captured the 21st century 9/11 truther style of capitalization. So whenever something spooky comes in, she capitalizes it so you don't miss the spooky.
Right.
But if you have a look here, you can see that the first two pages have no capitalization. That's because there's almost no spookiness happening, thanks to the irrelevant details.
Surely italics are the...
Tell it to Wilnecker. It's possible she didn't know how to get italics on Word. I wouldn't rule that out. So I'm going to, just as a sample, I'd like to read some of the Market Street Hauntings from Poole. Yeah, I just left a little space there in case you want to do the endorser joke.
I'll just edit.
Just edit,
it
just edit the exact same version. In. Here we go. This is the story that she was told by an architect who lives in Market Street. One night, he told me, a very strange thing happened. My son had been home on vacation writing one of his theses. I love the way parents drop that sort of thing. And, oh, he's writing several theses. He liked to work in the spare bedroom, which was used as a library slash workroom, and had gone out for the evening with a friend while I started work renovating a staircase, removing paint from the Victorian balusters. He continued walking on one of them for a couple of hours, and still it was not finished. I'm going to bed early, said his wife as she passed by. I'm getting a shocking cold. You'd better put up the bed in the spare room. Don't want to catch it, do you? He agreed and went on working, taking about another 15 minutes to complete the job. The pine looked lovely, and he couldn't resist running his fingers over the silkiness of the wood, thinking he might have been the first person to have touched the actual baluster in 200 years. He stroked the pine again, but now, as his fingers moved down the shaft of the miniature Tuscan column... James? As his fingers moved down the shaft of the miniature Tuscan column, so icy hands caressed his spine, moving endlessly. It was horrible, he told me. He went straight to the bathroom, turned on the hot tap, stripped and got in, feeling a sense of relief as the heat of the water restored him to normality. In bed he felt better, and must have slept until the early hours, when suddenly, without warning, heavy ironclad boots clobbered clumsily overhead. It's good alliteration. Strong men struggled, some sibilants, to move heavy chests, turning them on their corners, grinding in the gritty dust, splintering the boards and occasionally losing control, crashing the chests to the floor. He heard men's boots clattering as they lost their footing. It was terrifying. No attic floor could stand the impact. Panic-stricken, he jumped out of bed. Instantly, there was an uncanny silence. Cautiously, he climbed back into bed, and instantly the thunderous noise started up again. He shot out of bed and scurried into his wife's room, head cold or no head cold, hugging her tight for warmth and comfort. "Been dreaming," she slurred, and was asleep again. Next morning, he went out on the landing. To his horror, it was strewn with books and two chair seats. In one of the other rooms, an old teddy bear had been stuffed head first into the waste paper basket.
Oh.
In the spare room where he had started the night, his son's thesis papers... Just banging on about them. His son's thesis papers had been placed on the floor, still in order, at each of the three chairs they had been on, was wet. "You've not made it to the bathroom," was his wife's sceptic comment. It now has three asterisks indicating that's your lot for that story.
The end.
She then correlates a variety of other encounters in the same area that feature the same noises. So several months later, the previous owners of the house, who were friends of theirs, were invited to tea. The husband noticed the made alterations and was given a guided tour. As they passed the open door of the spare room, seeing it furnished, he said with a wry smile, "So you've cured the water problem."
Oh.
I think the implication here is that he means ghosts, not terrible plumbing in the house that I just sold you. And I'm going to read two more of the things to do with Market Street, which are a little tenuous. and to indicate capitalization, I will be shouting. In 1883, the Crown Hotel in Market Street experienced a piano-playing phantom in a room that contained no piano. The sound of two panic-stricken children, plus noises in the attic of clumping feet and the moving of great chests! Exclamation mark.
Right.
Furthermore, while looking through court documents of 1639 relating to the thefts of 5 barrels of gunpowder, she discovered the story of a certain William Fox, who said upon his oath that he had been at William Padner's house until about 10 of the clock. On departing, he met with Clement Short, a mariner, and went with him to his house. He stayed a while, talking of Newfoundland and sea matters, until about 1 of the clock. On the way to his lodgings, he heard whispering, rummaging, and a tumbling noise in one of the attics at Brown's Little Lane. Unfortunately, this name does not now exist. Did it lead into Market Street? There were 2 long barrels, 3 bigger ones, 4 smaller ones stored in Paradise cellars, containing various substances described as soap, mustard seed, and gunpowder. Could the guilty parties of long ago still be trying to move their ill-gotten wares? I mean, that took place in a different street. It didn't even take place in necessarily Market Street. Just a street that could theoretically have led to Market Street. So that was fairly disappointingly weak.
Yes.
But I was nervous that it might be a weak ending. So what I wanted to check was whether she was still with us. Because this was written in 1995.
Yes.
She has the prose of a doddery ant, engaging and yet rambling.
Yeah.
And so I thought it's possible that she's no longer with us. She hopes that when she dies, she'll find herself walking in a spirit with Bounty, spirit of her little dog. Can dogs become ghosts, you ask? She specifically deals with this.
Oh, good.
I hope Bounty's spirit will be there alongside me. Unlike most other animals, dogs and cats dream, so I'm sure they have souls too. Case closed.
Brilliant.
But I wanted to check, because I didn't want to be disrespectful, I wanted to check whether she was still with us, or I thought there might be an obituary if she had passed away.
And libel.
Yeah, exactly. And so I Googled her. And if you Google her, the first sort of 10 results are Amazon and Abe.com for Bounty Tale of a Dog. And then one of them is a Daily Mail headline.
Oh,
and the headline is, "Pensioner 81 banned from Dorset Beauty Spot." It's about Patricia Wilnecker.
Whoa!
And I thought, being the Daily Mail, I expected that she would have been banned from the beauty spot because of political correctness gone mad, or because benefit scroungers had built a mosque over the entrance, preventing her entrance and egress, or maybe trapping her in there.
Mm.
That's not it. When you click on the link, which I have done, I apologise, you get the full headline. "Pensioner 81, who visited the same beauty spot for 70 years, is banned from ever returning after the landowner accused her of mowing down his son with her car."
Oh, yeah. It is political correctness gone mad, isn't it? If you can't mow down a landowner's son.
Patricia Wilnecker has visited Lamorna Cove every year since 1948. She even moved to the area and wrote a book about the Cornish coast. You don't say. But landowner claims she deliberately knocked down his son, Daniel, 36. The best thing about this is she's been banned, and it uses Wilnecker-style writing. The word banned is capitalised. "Pensioner 81, banned from ever returning. Unless she tells him she's sorry." That's the best thing about it. Roy Stevenson said she can come back if she tells him she's sorry. She vehemently denies running down Daniel and will not apologise.
Fair enough. There are other ways of getting retribution for those sort of things, I think. Like the law, like how you're not allowed to run people over. You don't have to just apologise, like you can.
Also, I think likewise, other misdemeanors could be punished by banning you from Dorset beauty spots. So that's actually quite... I tell you what. Oh, no.
Oh,
really terrible news. Patricia Wilnecker, 81, pictured with her dog, Shorty.
Oh!
It looks exactly like Bounty, though.
Or maybe it's just better. Maybe she just replaced it with a better one and run the other one down.
That's really sad. So Bounty is already...
in the spirit realm.
In the spirit realm, well, waiting for... Well, this is 2015, so she might have joined, might have joined them.
Mm.
And, well, thankfully, Daniel survived the encounter, which may or may not have happened.
Well, because, yeah, because if he'd have got run over to death... then he could be out there kicking Bounty in the afterwards. Revenge.
So I'm presenting... normally, we do a local legend, but I think Patricia Wilnecker herself qualifies as a local legend.
Yeah, there's the legend of whether or not she ran over a man.
I mean, that in itself, if that had happened 100 years earlier, you'd be telling me that now as one of your stories.
Yes, because of libel.
Yeah, so she I'm not...
She didn't.
She didn't, as far as we know.
As far as she says. We know that much.
Allegedly. I'm just going to say the word allegedly, and you can edit appropriately. Allegedly.
To the scores.
Yes. So now I must ask you for your scores for Ghostly Tales of Wessex / Patricia M. Wilnecker, brackets, given half a chance, / I hardly know her. Should I give that a different title?
Let's do that. I think that's in keeping.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm surprised you didn't shout it.
All that was in caps.
Yeah. You just were in a different room.
So my first category is naming.
Okay, Wilnecker.
Wilnecker, good. Pool.
In Dorset. I've got the chance to say that many times.
Thanks to names. As an author, the names she gives to her stories, compelling. The Vanishing Boy.
A Strange Spoon.
But some of them are quite dramatic. The Many Ghosts of Lichet Matravers.
Ooh.
That sounds brilliant. The Ghostly Nun in Bournemouth Gardens. Coincidences?
If I were offered the opportunity to read a story called The Ghost That Scared the Plumber, I would.
Exactly. The Man Who Met Himself Coming Back! In the title. That's really good.
That sounds like a Morrissey song. It's even got mysteriousness in its naming format. Freshly Unearthed Ghostly Tales of Wessex.
Yeah, we're not sure on what's freshly unearthed.
Yeah, I'd give you, I think, a 4.
What?
I think... Because
what
no
more
one
could I have done?
No one in the story has a name. This son, this architect, they're just ciphers.
Well, they're real people, James. She's protecting their identity. Not like you and me, who've trotted out her dirty laundry in front of the microphone. She's protecting the architect who lives... Because you can probably find the architect who lives on Market Street Pool in Dorset easily. The least you can do is not put his name or her name. It was a man.
And then there was the road street name thing. She just probably couldn't find it. It's not that it's not there anymore. Do a bit more research, Patricia.
If you even read the book, James, you would know that she's never out of the court documents room translating historical documents into modern English. I put my money on Wilnecker.
She's not run someone over in there then, so she's still allowed
She's still allowed in currently.
No, it's going to be 4.
4!
Yeah.
Next, traditional category, supernatural.
Oh, hi. It's got to be 5. It is all about ghosts.
There's literally a ghost everywhere you turn. Or a noise.
A nightmare.
Someone clearly being asleep.
And paint fumes.
But I've only read you one of the stories.
And a leak.
There's a whole book of supernatural tales there.
There's not a whole book.
There's an entire pamphlet.
Yeah. Whilst it was supernatural, there wasn't the sort of explanation, the reasoning for these ghosts. That makes it seem more like it was just a man falling asleep in a different room and having a bit of a nightmare. He inhaled some paint fumes, had a bath, slept in a different room and moved some stuff around, had a nightmare. Very well told. I could very much imagine the sounds of the heavy ironclad boots and the heavy chest, the corners splintering, the planks? Floorboards.
Depends what the attic floor is like.
Thing. That detail there, though, that's what messes her up. Because when she comes to explain it, she definitely describes them as barrels. No corners on a barrel to splinter the ceiling wood. The thing we know about barrel.
You've nailed me.
They say it happened in an attic. The original events happened in a cellar. Doesn't add up, Patricia.
I feel like I'm on the stand and you cross-examined me.
Well, you've just been Grishamed. That's my new catchphrase.
So you started out saying that it was going to be a high score for Supernatural. It's all supernatural. It's got to be high, James Shakeshaft.
Yeah, So, but then I Columbo myself.
Then you Columbo yourself.
Yeah. I mean, there's even this... Even the previous owner as well casts his cheeky comment about the, oh, I see you solved the water problem. That is put there as to prop up the idea of supernatural events, chairs getting wet in the spare room. But then again, it also, it does sound like the brag of someone who's just ripped someone off.
Okay, that's not, yeah, I agree that's not conclusive. But James, the strange spoon.
Turned up in the coffee.
In the coffee jar, yeah. But she was sure it hadn't been in the coffee jar before.
Explain
that with your so-called science.
I can only explain that with 5 out of 5 for supernaturals. There's no other explanation.
Are you actually giving me 5 out of 5?
No.
Are you sarcastic? Because I'll take it even in sarcasm.
Put it in caps. If only there was such a thing as caps for numbers.
We need capital numbers.
Brilliant.
So it's 5. 5,
yeah, that is definitely. Yes! It is a 5 because it's all about.
Thank
those.
You, the strange spoon.
We can't get into the game of saying it might be someone just imagining it for every ghost thing because it usually is.
That way.
No podcast lies.
The blog factor.
Oh, blog factor, yes.
Because I feel like if she were writing now, and bless her, let's hope she is.
She's more being written about than writing, unfortunately.
Mm. Yeah, well, let's not talk about that, the incident.
If she were writing now, some people would hope it were a confession.
Or at least an apology to Daniel, 39. She doesn't have a blog, which is a tragedy.
Because really?
She was 81 3 years ago. But I feel like the content that she's delivering in pamphlet form almost sort of prefigures the blog.
Yeah.
And really would sit happily in a blog.
You can very much imagine that this as a blog with her unable to find a way to change the font and so just putting things in caps.
Yeah, it's in Comic Sans. Mm. The headlines are in papyrus, maybe.
Yeah, there is clip art. And
so much clip art.
There's definitely a dog background.
I think there might even be an animated GIF of Bounty.
Or a dog-like Bounty.
Yeah, not actually Bounty, yeah. Obviously.
All her hyperlinks are dead. That's their difficult second album. All my hyperlinks are dead.
What's your score then for the blog factor?
Oh, 5, obviously.
5.
Stapled pamphlets were the blogs of the 90s for people who couldn't set up a blog in the 90s because it was also a possible thing to do.
Think of the speed of dial-up in Poole.
That's true.
In 1995.
No, I wouldn't. It's terrible. I'm not surprised she hasn't got a blog, though, because if you're good at doing something, you don't do it for free. You put it in a pamphlet and sell it for a quid in an Oxfam.
Yeah, how much did I buy it for, actually?
A quid in an Oxfam.
A quid in an Oxfam. I thought that was a guess rather than that you had just read the label off the back of the book.
Yeah, I usually suspected you.
Yeah, you did. We also undermined the whole premise of the podcast medium.
What?
By suggesting that if you're good at something, you wouldn't do it for free.
Oh, yeah.
I was silent in a moment of sad self-awareness.
Oh. Yeah, we could sell this for a quid in Oxfam. Just on a cassette.
My final category. Ghostly incontinence.
Oh, yes.
Because the ghosts in the Market Street hauntings are different to most of the ghosts we've met in that they mainly manifest in the form of a wet chair. So moistened upholstery is unique to that story.
Because they'd moved some books around.
They'd moved books around. They'd put a teddy bear head first in a waste paper basket.
Oh, yeah, that put a human face on it for me.
I've simultaneously been imagining that being the beloved teddy bear of the son, who I now remember is writing several theses, probably grown out of the teddy bear.
I'm guessing 3 theses as well. Because there were 3 chairs that they'd been moved off of in order for the ghosts, these conscientious ghosts, to have a wee on? Or something.
I don't know what we're to believe the water is, bearing in mind that he did come out of the shower.
Yeah, after inhaling paint fumes and feeling dizzy.
Or paint stripper, in fact, so even worse than...
Yeah.
Even worse than paint fumes. Again, it's not our job to debunk or cast any doubt whatsoever on the validity of the stories.
Yes.
But also, I think incontinence runs as a theme throughout the book in the root sense of incontinence, meaning a lack of control.
Yes.
You know, so the ghosts are they're rearranging books and theses quite neatly, but still chaotically. They're putting a teddy bear upside down in a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then barrels are having their contents transferred to chests and then been moved from the cellar to the attic for no apparent reason.
Yeah, in multiple different houses on the same street, potentially.
Yeah. So explain that.
Well, that is truly unexplainable. because they're all random facts.
There is explainable as a series of unconnected things.
Yes.
Presented in a concise form.
Yeah. I give you one for each chair. So
what?
3 points.
I'm getting...
Or is there... No, it's 4 points, isn't it? Because there was another chair that had the inside taken out or something.
There were, hey, I'll tell you what. There were actually 2 Whoa. Seat cushions on the landing. So if we... If we give me a point for every seat-related bit of a haunting, then that's 5. So there's 3 seats with Wii on them. All
ghost Wii.
And 2 seat cushions.
Yeah, and there's a big pile of feces on the floor. 5.
I'm getting 5.
Probably. Yeah, you get
yes.
5.
Yes! Yeah, all right, yeah. I'm going to take the lid off next to the mic.
That's a good noise.
And I'm going to write the 5 right next to the microphone to celebrate.
In all caps. Oh, you could really hear the curl round of the
yeah,
fly.
Yeah, I did it absolutely
massive.
Do
you do the hat
massive.
First, then?
Yes, I do the hat first.
Oh, I do the down and then the round, and then I put the little hat on him. That is a big 5 as well.
I had to do it really big so the microphone could hear us.
You have been listening to Lawmen. The Lawmen are... Alistair Beckett King
and James Shakeshaft. If you enjoyed Lawmen, please rate and subscribe in all the usual places. But if you didn't enjoy it, we'll run over your son.
Allegedly.